The story, Half a Brain. My friend Denny called me often to his office to share valuable insights that he had learned from the Bible, and knowing my penchant for storytelling, the latest parables or stories he thought I might use. I grew to appreciate him very much. In one of those tragedies that I will not understand until I get to heaven, Denny had a heart attack as a very young man, apparently a genetic anomaly. Unfortunately, the medical people arrived in time to save his life, but not in time to save his brain. Now he was reduced to a 6-year-old in mentality. Though married, he did not understand what that meant. He spoke and thought as a child, until you got him into church. Whenever he was brought to church, as the songs were being sung, he sang as if he were normal. When the scripture was being quoted, his lips would move in remembrance. Something deeper than the damaged brain existed inside him, something that the damage could not touch, something written far deeper than simple memory. My mother-in-law, Elma, has lived to a great age and lived profitably. She resisted the prospect of being out of her home and in some sort of institutional care system. However, as Alzheimer's disease reduced her ability to care for herself, a serious hospital stay proved the successful bridge. By this time, most of her conversation was incoherent or wildly inappropriate. Except for one thing, which my wife reported to me after a stay with her. Whenever she prayed, her mind and her words were totally coherent and logical. As she lay helpless in the hospital bed, her spirit was not helpless. For long periods of time, she would march through her relatives' names praying for them, relate the need of her church in prayer, pray for people she didn't even know. Somehow, beneath all the brain cells affected by the disease, there lay a fully alert ability to communicate with her God. As long as she was talking to Him, she was totally coherent. My father was severely injured in an airplane accident as a young man, and he was left disabled with a damaged brain and a paralyzed left side. Throughout his now diminished life, he continued unswervingly to serve the Lord. Though livelihood now came from menial jobs rather than pastoring as in the past, his life of Bible study and worship and integrity never varied. Both my parents stood as giant examples for me to follow. Before my father died at age 65, brain surgery revealed that half of his brain was dead. For 32 years, he had lived for God with half of his brain dead. You can serve God with half a brain. There's hope for all of us. After publishing this story in my newsletter called Servant Quarters, I received the following letter in response. It's a classic. Dear Gail, about your recent article, Half a Brain, this is one of those notes where you want to be as visual and graphic as possible and know you'll fall short. My husband is brain damaged, one of the early drug rebels of the 60s and 70s. By God's limitless grace, I know who he is inside, and through much pain and growth over 20 years, it's enough. We are at great peace in our marriage and have a fine, godly son. But it's times like this morning when I read him the article that although he has no voice nor initiative to initiate any act, he is a responder. And if only you could have heard his response to that blessed article. A voice of laughter came through as he chuckled in agreement with every word. Again, remember, he has no voice. So it was miraculous in that sense and held so much joy that it needed to be shared. From Nancy in California. Discussion question 1. Describe someone you know who serves the Lord in spite of great disability. Question 2. What could shake your faith if it happened to you? Question 3. What measures are you taking to fill your spirit with good things? The story, Johnny Abide. My sophomore year in high school had more than its share of misery. In the 9th grade, I had begun to play football and was first team fullback. Now discount the fact that we lost all of our games. Then my family moved to a southern state and a city who viewed high school football as, well, semi-pro. Football took on a new meaning to me. In fact, the level of play in this new school was so high that they had 80 people who went out for football and only 79 uniforms. I did not dress out. I wasn't about to go to the games and have people ask me, "Aren't you supposed to be out there playing?" Well, you can say you're hurt only for so long a time. Well, my feelings were hurt. So in the absence of dressing for the games, I got involved in a series of church activities on Friday nights that grew in their success and effectiveness. The last game of the season coincided with a major church youth activity that we had planned. Then the bottom dropped out of my world. Several players had been injured and some had dropped out, so uniforms were now available for that last game. The coach said to me, "Gail, I want you to dress out for this last game." "Oh, Coach, I haven't been dressing out all season, and I've become involved in some church activities. This Friday night is our big night." "Gail, if you ever want to play on this team or be anything at this school, you'll dress out this Friday night."
"But, Coach, I'm in charge. I have to be at the meeting."
"Gail, you can get someone else to be in charge. You dress out." I walked in misery after that. There was no one else who could handle the responsibility. Each day brought me closer to that fateful decision. Inside, I shriveled noticeably. I wanted to be on the team. I wanted to be involved in school activities, and I also know that football and the coach had the power to destroy my future. Friday arrived. The teachers always let out football players early on Friday, and I managed to take advantage of that perk whether I dressed out or not. No joy accompanied the early release on that day. The decision could be delayed no longer. I leaned against my hallway locker, looking out on what I thought would be my last happy day. Suddenly, bounding up the stairway beside me came Johnny Abide. I didn't want to see Johnny. He was the football star. Every week, his name filled the sports page. Johnny Abide scores 300 points. Johnny Abide runs 700-yard touchdown. He was the last person I wanted to see, but I could not escape. "Gail, what's wrong with you? You look like your world has caved in. What's going on?" I decided to tell him, "Johnny, you know I've not been dressing out this season for the game, so I've become very involved in some church activities that take place on Friday nights. Well, tonight's our big event. But the coaches told me I have to dress out now that some uniforms are available. I don't know what to do." "Gail, I don't believe this. If you dress out tonight, I will personally beat you up." My decision was getting clearer. I'm a football star. I knew that. and my picture's in the paper every week. But after I leave this school, they'll forget about me, and all that stuff will not help me one bit. What you're doing is eternal and doesn't even compare with this stupid game. If you're willing to give up something that worthwhile just to dress out for one game, you're not as smart as I thought you were. I will personally beat you up. My decision was made. I did not know that Johnny was a Christian. He moved in different circles than I. My heart was free. The coach never noticed I wasn't there. Well, the next season, next two seasons, I made the first team. At the end of my high school days, the coach wrote a letter of recommendation for me that stated that he hoped his two sons would turn out just like me. Yet I came so close to ditching my responsibilities for such worthless reasons. I don't like getting beat up. I guess the Lord knew that. Discussion question one. Describe some major decisions you've made in your life. Did anyone help you make them? Question two. When have you been surprised at how well things turned out for you after you made a right but difficult choice? Question three. In what areas do you not see clearly? And how do you seek help in those areas? The story, Eugene. Puberty clobbered me terminally about age 13. Life and decisions and feelings tugged relentlessly and pulled me along in its turbulent cloud of dust. I needed help. Enter Eugene. Eugene, my junior high school Sunday school teacher, sensed my need and moved gently into my life. No patronizing, "Be at ease, kid, I am here." Instead, he made me feel that the finest thing that could happen to him would be for me to spend time with him on Saturdays. So I was willing to bless him. We attended baseball games, played miniature golf, drank root beer, and talked. And talked and talked. I found myself wanting to serve God like Eugene. Perhaps you would never know him if I didn't tell you this story. Not much recommended him to the world. He had no high-paying job or big house or social position or memorable looks. He was simply a servant, sensitive to those young people who might need help. He was an excellent violin player, but received few accolades in the church world. Nonetheless, he had touched me significantly during a most needy time of my life. When I left that city at the end of my junior high days, I didn't thank him for what he had done for me. Junior hires don't know that word. I didn't write to him. Junior hires are illiterate. As far as I knew, he dropped off the surface of the earth. I knew nothing more of him except his signature on my soul. 16 years later, now on the headquarters staff of a denomination, I sat in my corner office doing what editors do when I heard his voice. "Is this where you subscribe to Youth Alive?" Memories flooded me as I jumped up and ran to the front. "Eugene!" He looked at me for a few seconds and responded, "Are you Gail Irwin?" "Yes." "What are you doing here?" He probably thought I was in prison by now. "You don't know?" "No, my daughter's come here to nursing school, and I want to subscribe to this magazine for it. It's the best thing I've ever seen." "You don't know that I created it and edited it?" "No, you're kidding." "Eugene, this is just the bread you cast on the water coming home to you. You blessed me when I was a teenager, and now I get to bless your daughter. This is what happens in the kingdom of God." We reminisced for a while and then parted. I didn't know if I would ever see him again, but one day he called and said he was coming to see his daughter in school and accepted my invitation to stay at our house. That night, my wife suffered a painful miscarriage. Once again, I found Eugene ministering to us at a time of need. I developed a close friendship with the state youth leader where Eugene lived. During one of our talk times, we discovered that we both attended the same church during junior high days. Why didn't I know you then? I asked. Well, because you're 2 years older than I am and wouldn't give me the time of day. Oh. Then I remembered. There was a teacher in that church who deeply touched my life. Before I could say another word, he blurted out, "It was Eugene, wasn't it?"
"Yes."
"Me too. You see, I'm an orphan, and I really needed help at that age. Eugene seemed to sense that and just moved into my life." We marveled at God's faithfulness to us and thanked him for sending Eugene. Well, Eugene moved. I didn't know that. And I moved. He didn't know that. And once again, we dropped off each other's radar screen. I was to have two more significant meetings with him, however, but one was not face to face. When I first flew to California to prepare to move, I rose early, bought an Orange County newspaper to look for a house to rent. Since I'm a news hound, I took my time getting to the classifieds. On page 2, a small paragraph item caught my eye. The city water utility of an Oklahoma town had just received a check from Eugene years after he had moved away. Enclosed was a letter of apology. He stated that the bill was lost in the move, and now that he had found it, as a Christian, he must pay the full amount with interest. So rare an ethic had made it all the way to a California newspaper. 20 more years passed without seeing him until one day he found out that I was coming to Dallas to teach at a church. He made his way there that morning to hear me speak to an audience. This would be the first time for him to hear me ever. When I stood to speak and saw him sitting on the back pew, I paused and informed the congregation that a person who had helped shape my life as a teenager was present, and I wanted them to hear his story. I briefly condensed the story of the effect Eugene had on me and expressed my gratitude to him. I looked back at him and shouldn't have. He was crying. Discussion question 1. Name 2 people other than your parents who have influenced your life and tell how they did. Question 2. What teacher in school of any type has been the most effective for you? Question 3. Whom did you last call or write and say thank you? The story. Agnes. Some people apparently get their training in the fire, the Kingdom of God School of Survival. This is about just such a person, a lady. Her father was hostile to the kingdom and would gladly have stolen her faith. However, as a teenage girl, her direction was chosen. Nothing turned her to the side, although God knows all hell would try. Agnes' commitment to God took her to a small Bible school far from her home. A revival was flourishing, and she had identified with a young denomination. Agnes Pauline Mayo traveled the formidable distance from Mississippi to the farm and oil town of Enid, Oklahoma, to what was then known as Southwestern Bible School. She was pulled swiftly into the fast lane of life at the school. There, she met an energetic young man straight off the farm, a go-getter headed for the top. She married this man named Kenneth. 18 months later, a son was added to their union. This son would try her and put her through the first survival ringer as a mother. He was born ugly and large-nosed. At 3 months of age, he gave up naps, preferring to demand the constant attention of all persons, whether awake or not. At this time, she determined that he would be an only child. Not only did she have to nurture this child whose grandparents had called him in a not too complimentary way, Meddlesome Matty, but much of the early child rearing occurred without a home. The traveling lifestyle of her preacher husband placed her constantly in the homes of others. Not an easy task when you are breastfeeding a hurricane, or at least a strong gale. Life was filled with embarrassing moments. Many complained that she did not discipline the little beast often enough. Others thought that maybe the spankings were why he was so bad. Watching him drag wet newspapers into a church meeting while wearing a mud-caked white suit caused many to doubt her child-rearing abilities. 20 years later, people would step back in wonder when meeting that child again, in wonder that he was still alive and not in prison. Destiny in a small plane. The desire to introduce people to Jesus led them to a booming war industry town on the coast of Mississippi to begin a new church. The task would not be easy. Living in the curtained-off corner of a dirt-floored wooden tabernacle was hardly the dream of a bride, but it was for the Lord, and that was enough. When they did get a small house, the little beast, whom they had the courage and audacity to name Gale, attempted to burn it down. She was forced to learn to jog long before the world would join the craze. Many hours were lost as workers on the new church being built next door would stop to watch as she, with switch in hand, chased the beast around the house, shouting threats of ultimate destruction if he didn't stop and get his whipping. A second son was born who further tested her patience. This new son quickly used his newfound ability of walking to do just that. Police and radio listeners were frequently called to help find this new explorer. He also disliked clothing and would dispense with it in church as soon as she turned her back. There was still never a home or a nest where she could rest as she raised the children. Once the new church building was completed enough to occupy, the back of the basement became living quarters. A water hose hanging over a sheet of plywood became the outside shower that you dared to use only at night. In that basement home, the news came that would permanently change her life and extract more from her than she ever thought she could give, the trial that would move her to greatness. Word came that her husband had been injured in an airplane accident. Now she was a poverty-stricken mother, wife, nurse, and breadwinner. Now a home broken in body moved from basement to farm to trailer to shack to house to low-paying job to less-paying job. A world now rested on her shoulders. The broken, healthy home. One thing kept her going. She was in the service of God. Whatever the price or difficulty, it faded compared to the reward that she knew God had waiting. Indeed, what the world would have called a dysfunctional family was indeed a stable, God-fearing home. How could that be? The answer was simple. My mother was a saint first, and mother second. The things that were supposed to happen in church happened in our home. Prayer, songs, Bible study, and faith were not reserved for the pew, but occurred at the breakfast table, the couch, the bedside. Testimony to this fact is that her sons all follow the Lord. The school of testing was unrelenting. Sometimes when it seemed that every miracle would wait until the last minute before happening, I could hear her crying and praying as she asked the Lord how long this would continue. A third son came along and she had to feed 5 stomachs. I would like to say that life became easy and wealth flowed her way, but I can't. None of her sons became president nor rich. yet the family never dipped into the pockets of the welfare system. The budding brain surgeon, who was her first son, merely became another preacher, and the best he, the little beast named Gale, can do for her is write this tribute and help fulfill her desire to introduce people to Jesus. But one thing overrides all else. Her life was lived unquestioningly for the Lord. Agnes Pauline Mayo Irwin was thoroughly saved. After 32 years of caring for her invalid husband, death separated them. That had been her vow 40 years earlier, "Till death do us part." She kept her promise. God had joys still waiting for her. Another man, Raymond, came into her life, and she became Agnes Pauline Mayo Irwin Baser. We still call her Mom for short. Probably should call her Saint Mom. Her new husband, a saint himself, is restoring what the cankerworm had eaten. In November of 1992, she celebrated 75 years, Saint Mom. During that November, one of the churches she helped found honored her work. Along with them, we, Gail Dean, Jess Matthew, and Kenneth Wayne, her sons, rose up and called her blessed. Discussion question number one. What is the Mother's Day ritual at your house? If your mother isn't living, what were the rituals that you remember? Question two. What kinds of pain and heartache did you bring to your mother? How have you tried to heal that? Question three. What are the greatest joys you have when you are around your mother or think of her? The story, Welcome, Now Leave. Our sojourn in that city began in a most unusual manner. The decision had been made to return from living in Oklahoma City to start a new church. The house they found that was available had been lived in by a city official. My parents purchased it. The neighborhood knew that church building plans were being made for the adjacent vacant lot. This was not to the neighborhood's liking. When we arrived with our furniture, we were met at the door by a representative of the neighborhood with a petition signed by everyone except one person within a 3-block radius, informing us that we were not welcome and all legal efforts would be made to block our activities. They felt that we would lower the value of their property and they did not want another church. For months, no one would speak to us. Our neighbor behind us, a policeman and ringleader of the petition effort, would throw his garbage over the fence onto our property. He poisoned our dog, Buster. He had two large, aggressive dogs that he sent out to attack my father when he was out for a walk. Since my father's left side was paralyzed, he could not run, and as he tried to escape, the dogs chewed up his left hand that hung limp from his disabled shoulder. This policeman appears again at the end of our story. We cleaned up the house and the adjacent lot and carted away loads of empty liquor bottles in the garage and on the grounds. The fears of the neighborhood were obviously unfounded. One by one, beginning with our next-door neighbors and often with tears, the people of the neighborhood came and asked forgiveness and asked to personally scratch their names off the petition. When the process was over, only one person's name remained on the petition, the policeman in the house behind us. His signature remains on the petition to this day, but let's come back to him later. I became immediately active in the high school and began to be known in the city. Every week my name would be in the city newspaper for some school or community activity. I was on the football team and captain of the debate team. By the end of my junior year, my activities had enlarged to being president of several school organizations, state president of the High Y, and finally president of the student body. Between junior and senior years, I was chosen to be one of the representatives to the city to the Boys State program. Well, one of the graduating senior leaders strongly urged me to run for governor of Boys State. I reluctantly agreed to do so and was indeed elected to that position, as well as sent to Boys Nation in Washington, D.C. Being governor of Boys State was a high honor for that town, and when I returned from the state capital, a crowd had gathered at the steps of the city hall where the American Legion, who sponsored the activity, waited to honor me and my parents. At the city limits, a police motorcade waited to lead the car I was in, with sirens screaming, to the city hall. Yes, you're ahead of me. Leading the way on his motorcycle was the policeman who lived behind me. In the book of Esther, Haman built a noose to hang Mordecai, Esther's uncle, but found the rope around his own neck instead. Haman rides again. Discussion questions. 1. Have you ever been persecuted because you were a Christian, and how did it happen? 2. What ways have you seen someone try to destroy a person and instead get destroyed himself? A hint, look at politics. 3. Have you ever tried to simply do something good and had people misunderstand? Tell about your experience. Did their misunderstanding stop you? The story, Great Launch. My wife and I made a sentimental journey to the city of my undergraduate college. Warm memories surround the Griffiths, the Lovetts, the Sanders, the Sconyers, and others in that city. None of these families permitted me to spend a weekend in the dormitory of the college. If I were sick, it must be at their house, not in the dormitory room. To honor them, I named my son Clyde from a representative name of that group of men. Ada and I married while I was in college and ferried ourselves around in a car that needed towing more than driving. You might want to see the fleece story, by the way. We traded it for one barely better, but at least our feet didn't go through the floorboard. That second car triggered an event I shall never forget. I was part of the jail ministry sponsored by the Salvation Army, but peopled by these men, truck drivers all, who surrounded me. One Sunday morning, as we descended from the upper floor of the jail in the two-person elevator, Clyde called me aside and said, "Gail, your car's not going to make it. When you graduate and leave to begin preaching, why not take my new foreign car?" By the way, foreign cars were novelties, and this one was as precious as a child to him. "And why don't you drive it until you can afford a car of your own?" I was overwhelmed and told him I'd consider his generous offer. He had just finished when J.C. called me aside and said, "Gail, your car is not going to make it. Why don't you take my car and use it until you can get your own?" My wife and I never drive our car because of the company truck I have. I believed them about my car, but hesitated to accept such a large gift from either of them. I didn't know what to do. I planned to take my wife and our daughter Gloria across country preaching as soon as I was graduated. I decided to attempt to purchase a new car. Much to my amazement, I was able to buy a compact car in the second year they were out, though I told the credit manager I did not have a job, had no money except the $100 I paid down, had no promise of a job, and had no idea how much I would be making, if any. Why they gave me the loan still causes me to think a miracle occurred. On this sentimental journey, we visited Charles and Murtis, people we hold in highest respect and for good reason. On the night of my graduation, and before the morning that we were to leave on our mission of message, they had insisted that we come to their house. Around coffee and pie, Charles said, All I own belongs to you. Don't ever let your family go hungry or be deprived as long as I have anything, because it's yours as much as mine." We left that city with warm and reeling hearts. I knew that God had brought me to that city not to attend a world-class college, but to teach me what love in the body of Christ actually meant. Discussion questions. Number one, who helped you get a start in life, and what did they do? Number two, when you need to fall back on someone, who is it? Number three, in what ways are you trying to help someone achieve their goals in life? The story, the day I turned professional. Mrs. Craig, my first grade Sunday school teacher, held a special place in my heart. I can still see and hear her playing her mandolin, teaching us songs in the little country church in northwest Oklahoma near Chester. See if you can find it on a map. Occasionally they would invite me to spend Sunday afternoon or a few days at their house. One of those pleasant times overlapped with the 4th of July. I was 7 years old. Chester, have you found it yet? Though a small crossroad village, was a major holiday gathering place for the surrounding farming and ranching community. On the 4th, they would gather to dance, play baseball, what else, have turtle races, dryland terrapins, actually. It was a whole family event that also included races for the children. I had never been in a real foot race before and really didn't want to risk the embarrassment of a loss to these unknown kids. I entered the race only because the moderator was aggressive in getting us together. Then, suddenly, one small event changed the whole scene. The leader lined us 7-year-olds up, then pulled a big bag full of change. I really don't intend this to be a pun, by the way. Out of a sack and announced that a handful of this would go to the winner. I don't know how to describe what happened. It's hard to be philosophical about the emotions of one so young. Desperation did not drive me, nor resignation, nor ego. Greed. Simply greed. At any rate, I won by several bellies going away. I think I remember a gasp from the spectators. They knew they were seeing a world-class performance. Only one problem remained. Everyone knew everyone at this gathering, but no one knew me. There was some hesitancy at turning this money over to a complete stranger, and I watched as the call went out for someone to identify me. I told them I was staying with the Craigs, who unfortunately were not around at the moment. Finally, reluctantly, they turned the $1.65 over to me, and I held in my hand what was, to me, a year's salary. Now, I hope this revelation of my turning professional will not cause my high school or college to be forced to forfeit any games. I won't worry about junior high school. We lost all 6 football games anyway. Discussion questions. Number one, what trophies do you have of your past achievements? Number two, when and how did you discover some of your main capabilities? Number three, did you have a childhood adult friend who treated you with special love? Describe them. The story, Call Me Mister. Dr. Bill McGowan and his wife, Renee, welcomed me into their home on my first trip to Umtali on the Mozambique border of what was then called Rhodesia in southern Africa. As an orthopedic surgeon, the raging civil war kept Bill busy, and they were somewhat surprised that I had risked sniper fire along the 120-mile stretch of highway between Salisbury, now Harare, and Umtali, now Mutare, to speak in their town. Yeah, I tried to think of some way to appear brave, but finally admitted that I was unaware of the road danger until along the way my driver asked if I minded that he was armed. Only later did I discover that I was asked to go to Umtali because the other speakers at a conference that brought me to the country refused to go. Well, their beautiful home backed against a game reserve, and Bill was once, as he lounged by his pool, temporarily and painfully blinded by a spitting cobra that wandered onto his property. Living in this Garden of Eden land produced a few items to keep you alert. Bill, a quiet, thoughtful, sometimes morose person, and I developed a special relationship. Each year, when I would go to their country, now called Zimbabwe, I would stay at least a few nights with them, and at some point would bait Bill and purposely draw him into a medical and ethical argument with a broadside against the medical profession. We kept at it for hours, back and forth, through the house, at the table, in the pool. He would lose his cool by splashing water on me, or temporarily stomping off, or threatening to rearrange my body parts if he ever had to operate on me. I thought I was merely having fun until one day when he had gone to another part of the house, stomped off actually, Renee thanked me. She said, "The only time Bill ever brightens up with the war and everything going on is when you come and bait him, and I really appreciate your bringing him out." I promised to keep a good fight plan for his sake. A renewal experience made Bill's commitment to God run deep, and he sought ways to quietly serve the body of Christ. For a period of time, he published a renewal magazine that he especially wanted to distribute among Anglicans where he attended church. He was a solid man. My last visit with Bill before his death shocked me and provided the reason for this story. We sat at a table for another unusually good meal. Incidentally, the British are not famous for cuisine. "Dr. Bill," I said with mock emphasis, "what is your latest malpractice?" Ignoring my question, he curtly spouted, "Call me Mister." I responded, "Well, have you quit being a doctor, or have they kicked you out?" He silently and intently stared at me while Renee jumped in to explain. Yes, she said, "in our country, if you have served as a doctor in a long and outstanding manner, they restore to you the title of Mister. It's the highest honor." I sat amazed. "When they know you're a doctor, but they call you Mister, you have reached the highest in your profession." His membership in the Royal College of Surgeons paled in the light of this honor. What an excellent illustration of Jesus, I thought. The Son of God becomes known as the Son of Man. The King of Kings becomes the servant of all. The height and goal of both Bill and Jesus was to be numbered among the transgressors. Some traditions are worth keeping. Now I just hope someone is keeping the arguments going with Bill in heaven. In the meantime, anyone know a good mister I can go to? Discussion questions. Number one, with whom do you have your most fun discussions? And what's the usual subject? Number two, have you seen any of your friends highly honored? How did you participate? Number three, do you ever have friendly arguments? Over what? The story, Rhino versus Elephant. The game park behind Bill and Renee McGowan's house fielded spectacular views of wild animals in their natural habitat. On one viewing platform, we watched a drama unfold that had spiritual implications. An elephant with a young cow and a rhinoceros were in a clearing together. The rhinoceros, a frustrated female who had no baby in her care, jealously attempted to get between the elephant and her baby and take the little elephant away to be her own. The activity was intense, but the rhinoceros had two problems to overcome, a furious mother and a determined baby. The rhino had a full-time job keeping the baby elephant away from its mother because that baby elephant exhibited full determination to get back to its mother. The rhino could not give full attention to the baby because she had to also keep a defensive eye out for the mother elephant. I asked McGowan who the victor would be in a full-on war between an elephant and a rhinoceros. He said the outcome was uncertain. Either could win, however they would need full attention to the battle, which this rhino could not afford. As I watched, I thought, Satan may attempt to get between us and God and pull us away to be his own, but he faces two problems that approach being insurmountable. One, a furious God, and second, a child determined to get back to its father. Discussion question. Number one, can you remember how you felt as a child when you were separated from your parents? Describe it. Number two, when you are away from church and the body of Christ for a while, what's the effect on you? Number three, how might Satan most likely try to separate you from God? The story, feedback. I rarely spoke at meetings of a certain large international men's organization. My story and style simply lacked the snap that they sought. However, the influence of a pastor for whom I was speaking snagged an invitation to speak at a Saturday breakfast meeting in this state's capital. Well, we arrived about 20 minutes early and entered a hall with places set for 150 people. 20 people were gathered in one corner, energetically chatting. The local president and moderator introduced himself to me, welcomed me, then led me to the head table where I would be seated. A small chalkboard stood behind the table, evidence that chalkboard was not the norm for their sessions. By the time breakfast began, only 25 people had arrived, all huddled near the front. Throughout the breakfast, the president, sitting next to me, voiced his disappointment. I wonder where everyone is. We always fill this room. Why aren't they here today? We advertise this very well. We put your picture in the paper. I could see where his mind was going as he sought to lay blame for the day. Finally, he asked the question that I knew would come. Tell me just who you are. What is your story? I responded that I was not really well known. I merely traveled and spoke about the nature of Jesus. He stared at me for a few seconds, and I could see the decision forming in his mind. He was now convinced that he had booked a loser, and something must be done to save the day. He launched a jazz-em-up, dance-the-aisles, make-em-happy time that lasted for 1.5 hours. It was important to make them glad they had come, since future attendances at breakfast were at stake. Well, I knew what was going on, and frankly, I steamed inside and withered outside. When he finally released me to speak, I decided this would obviously be the only time here for me, and I determined not to let this guy terminate the message. I spoke for 1.5 hours, delivering as entire a basic nature of Jesus seminar as I could. Then I sat down. It was noon. Silence. After an eternity, one of the men spoke up and said, I guess you'd like some feedback, wouldn't you? I stretched the truth severely and said, yes. Actually, I wanted to get out of there as fast as I could and erase the memory of the day. The man continued, Do you know who I am? No. I'm the lieutenant governor of this state, and until 2 weeks ago, I was running for governor. But God spoke to my heart and told me to get out of the race because I did not understand leadership. So I obeyed. Today, I have learned the things I did not understand. Thank you. Would you be willing to share this with our legislature? I never saw this man again, and I don't know if he ever ran for governor. I really doubt that he did. However, from time to time, I would see small items in national newspapers with his name in the article. His name was always associated with some servant-hearted event or action that he was doing for people who could not help themselves. A governor would have been a step down for such a servant. Discussion. Number one. Have you ever had great things expected from you and you felt that you let people down? Describe. Number two. If you had a midlife career change, what might you do? Number three. If you could do something good that no one would know about, what would it be?